I'm Gabby Reese, and welcome to the show.
At that point, I thought, well, maybe we could use cold water swimming as a treatment for depression. When you come out of the water, I feel alert, alive, and I have a sense of euphoria and achievement. And, you know, the act of taking a pill is never going to give you that. And that's what you get from the swimming.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. My guest today is Mark Harper. And Mark is a consultant anesthesiist at Brighton and Sussex University Hospital, who, after he became an anesthesiologist and was in school, he was trying to study the negative effects of getting cold during surgical operations. I don't know if you've ever come out of surgery and you can be, you know, really cold, like freezing. They give you those shiny blankets. But inadvertently and sort of unrelated, this brought him to the positive effects of cold water swimming. And he has a new book out called Chill. And he shares his journey into cold water swimming and the amazing impact it not only had on him, but on others, people with anxiety and depression, PTSD, migraines, autoimmune disease, and so much more. And he also breaks it down for us how to, if you sort of think, oh, this is for me, I can take this on once a week, a step-by-step explanation on just how to get started swimming into cold water, because it feels intimidating, but he makes it achievable and it doesn't have to be ice water. He's saying, listen, even everything sort of under 68 degrees, you can really get a lot of benefits from if you can get in there once a week. There's a community aspect and he breaks it all down. He is very passionate about the swimming and there's over 7 million people in England alone that are doing this. We've all heard of this, Wim Hof, and everybody's icing and doing heat. And this is just another way to support ourselves and our well-being. Hope you enjoy. So Dr. Mark Harper, thank you and welcome to the show. I'm excited about your new book, Chill. I think we could all use a little more of that. That comes out July the 12th. Maybe you could just sort of share your journey from being a doctor of anesthesiology to this sort of other new additional part of your life that brought you, I mean, you were compelled enough to write a book. I always think people are committed to something when they really write a book. So maybe you could just share your journey.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a sort of long and winding journey, which goes back to going skiing. So I was in the middle of my specialist training as an anesthesiologist, and I decided to take 6 months off and go and work in a ski resort. Nothing anesthetic. You know, I was just guiding people around the mountains, enjoying the snow. And just before I went, my program director rang me and said, "Yeah, I think you should apply for this job." I said, "That'd be really nice, but I'm not gonna. You know, I'm going skiing instead." He said, "Not going to advance your career very much." In the nicest possible way, he's a great guy. And ironically, nothing has had more effect on my career than that. So off the back of that, I started organizing a meeting in a French ski resort. And the first time we held the meeting, I thought, well, I've got to find a subject that is relevant. And I thought, well, hypothermia, that's a relevant subject. And from that, I went on to research hypothermia during surgery. Now, getting cold is always bad for you. Exposing yourself to that cold, that's what we're talking about here. Getting cold, no. And you get cold during an operation, that's really bad for you. And because you have more complications, it increases the stress on the system and you get more complications. Now, while I was researching this, I started coming across articles about cold adaptation, how people adapted to cold water swimming. And I looked at that and I thought, well, in my patients, I want to reduce the stress response. I mean, we all need a stress response. I mean, evolutionarily keeps us alive, but we don't want too much of the stress response. What I want to do is reduce this stress response in my patients. And because, you know, when you have an operation, although you don't feel anything, your body reacts as if it's still having this massive insult. And, you know, you get all those things, the inflammation and things like this that just go crazy. So I thought, well, with the cold stress response, that's the same as the surgical stress response. And if you adapt to cold, that gives you a reduction in the stress response, which would be really good for my surgical patients. Mm-hmm. Now, that remains only theoretical. I published a theoretical paper on it. But from there, I moved on to, Well, the next stage was...
Wait, Mark, before we leave there, because I think this is very interesting, because one of the scariest things about getting surgery is being put under, I think. You know, they're talking about controlled death. I think for a lot of people, that's one of the scarier elements to it. I've just never heard of somebody who's in that part of the practice thinking way ahead. A lot of times your doctor might say, for example, if you're having an orthopedic surgery, hey, let's get that muscle as strong as we can before you come in and we do this surgery so your rehab's better, things like that. But I'm curious as to, as a young person, how you were thinking, because were you able to have access to patients sort of weeks? Were you thinking, oh, I'm going to be able to talk to patients weeks before surgery?
Well, that's ideally what we do. And there is a broader movement now towards what's called prehabilitation. And that's things, you know, like what you're saying, like the getting yourself fit and healthy before. But what we want to do is reduce that inflammatory response. And no one's really done this yet. And we do have clinics now where the patients come in 2, 3, 4 weeks before surgery. And so we do have access to them. However, no one has taken on my theory to try it out in practice yet.
Do they? Because I feel like where you live, you might be ahead of where we are a little bit in the States, as far as connecting all the elements to health and healing and such. I'm just curious, do you all talk about besides the movements, do you add the other components of health? Do you talk about an anti-inflammatory diet or anything like that to the patients prior to coming in? Or is that, like you said, is that still not been widely adopted yet?
Unfortunately, it's still not being widely adopted. There are a few things. In fact, the things that are done are more not kind of drug related, but they're things like, yeah, you have a drink just before, you have a sports drink before you start, and things like this to sort of get your sugar levels up before you start, and things like this. So there are a few things, but that's not anti-inflammatory at all. So.
And I think what you were seeing too is a lot of patients after surgery, I've experienced it after surgery, you do get cold.
Yes, and this is it. So people expect pain after surgery. And people kind of expect, sometimes they might expect to be a bit sick after surgery. But the thing that people don't expect is being cold. That's just one of the worst feelings. You know, I've spoken to many patients about this. And the worst thing is this shivering and being cold afterwards. Mm-hmm.
So in this sort of theory of yours, that this led you to thinking about ways or what environments or elements people could do to get that adaptation. So what was that journey like?
Well, I suppose the next stage, so that was that part of the journey, but the next stage of the journey is my journey to, as you say, now I'm looking at mental health. I'm an anesthesiologist. Yeah, I use drugs. I put people to sleep. I don't talk to them. I don't deal with their mental health, except in that really quick interaction. Yeah, so it's a very important interaction, but it's not a very long interaction I have with them before they go off to sleep. So that came about because I'm a swimmer. You know, I grew up swimming. That's my exercise. That's how I keep fit, is by swimming in the pool. But then I was complaining, as in my mid-30s, I just started an attending by a consultant as an anaesthetist. And I was complaining to an old friend of mine, the swimming pool shut for 2 weeks. I'm going to be really bored. I don't like it. He said, just go and join the sea swimming group. I didn't realize the club had a sea swimming group. I said, well, when do they swim? 7 o'clock. Well, when? He said, all year round. Really? Yeah, I was as shocked as anyone. And that first time, so those 2 weeks, so it was for 2 weeks in the summer, top of the temperature, you know, 20 degrees, I think that's about 68 Fahrenheit. So it wasn't cold at all. But I still remember after my first swim, walking up the beach, probably a kilometre and a half swim, nothing particularly much, walking up the beach and thinking, God, I feel good. And it was, yeah, I was just amazed. I wasn't expecting that. And then probably a few years later, I read an article in the newspaper, and what this did was it linked inflammation with depression. It described depression as maybe an allergic reaction. And I thought, well, knowing my stuff now from what we call perioperative hypothermia, I thought, well, if you can adapt people, you know, one of the main reasons, my main theories that it would work for my surgical patients was that it reduces your levels of inflammation. Again, you want inflammation. It's first line of defense, but you don't want too much of it. You want it in the good physiological zone, not the bad pathological zone. And I thought, well, if you can adapt patients, you know, you reduce their inflammation through cold water adaptation, and depression is linked to inflammation, well, maybe. And I feel so good when I go for a swim. That's why, yeah, at that point, you know, those 2 weeks have become 20 years. At that point, I thought, well, maybe we could use cold water swimming as a treatment for depression.
And who, was it a female? You had a woman, I believe, who's the first to kind of, how do you pitch this to somebody? Because
I'll tell you the story. That's quite So basically, the way this came about then after that was I met this guy, Professor Mike Tipton, great guy, really good friend of mine now. First time I've met him. And I pitched this idea to him. Now, he is the guy who'd been doing all these studies on cold adaptation. Yeah, he is the guru of cold adaptation, and he's a physiologist. And I pitched this idea to him. He said, yeah, that's really interesting. He'd not thought about that, but yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. And then just a couple of months later, he was contacted by a television doctor, Chris Van Tulliken, who had this idea about doing a program, the doctor who gave up drugs. He said, well, is there anything that we can use cold water for? And he said, well, that's funny you should say that, because I've just met this guy who thinks you could use it for depression. So the pitch was to Sarah, the pitch went out, you know, they had to find a patient with depression who was willing to come on TV. And so this was Sarah, and she was 24 at the time, been on antidepressants since she was 16. Her father had committed suicide, her brother had died of an overdose. She was a single mum, but she was determined not to let her daughter grow up with seeing her mum take pills. So it was pitched to her by the BBC, I suppose, and Chris Van Tulliken.
And how do you take, because I just know this, you know, we have an icing practice at our house, you know, probably for like maybe the last 8 years, 3 minutes in the ice. And we always joke that you're just happy to be alive when you get out. You know, it's like, and I know there's hormone regulation and maybe an order of importance, like you're under threat. And to your point, your body, I think, sort of adapts and is, all of a sudden certain things go right out the window and you're in the present and these things. But getting people into cold is so interesting because there is so much negative talk around cold. Don't get a cold, watch out, you're going to be cold. And I think what's important is when you get introduced this, at least, you know, from our point of view, and I see that when in your book Chill, you talk about this, where it's getting people to understand that it's an okay threat, and it is going to be cold, and you can survive it. So how do you propose when you have Sarah, how do you get her? And I know she was motivated, you know, motivated by her own experience and then with her daughter, but what is your way of sort of coaching or making the transition for somebody who's going to do this for the first time easier?
I think the bottom line is you've got to go in with it being clear that you don't have to be in for too long. It doesn't have to be too cold, and you don't actually have to do it that often to have a good effect. So one of the things is, like with everything, it's honesty. And there is, God, I remember when I was a really junior doctor having to give patients bad news, you know, they're father, yeah, I worked on intensive care, their father, their loved one was dying. And I was always honest. Yeah, I was always open. And the number of times people came back to me saying, thank you so much, we really appreciate that. Yeah, horrible business, but that's what they did. And so it's going in and it's preparing them for, yes, it's going to be a hard experience. You know, even after 20 years, I still hate getting into the cold. I hate getting into it. I know what's the other side, and that's why I do it. And it's saying, well, look, this is going to be a bit like a panic attack, you know, because you start hyperventilating and you've got to realize this is it. You won't be able to control your breath.
Right.
But a little later, it doesn't take long, a minute or so, you just stay in that little bit longer and you will, your breathing will come back under your control. And I think that's part of it. It's part of this challenge. You overcome a challenge. You say, oh, that was so scary. And that scariness is kind of enhanced by the hyperventilation and the seeming panic attack. And so just go in, just stay in that that bit longer, and you will see it pass.
And I feel like it's somehow, you said it sort of has a metaphorical component to it, where when you face these things that are ultimately positive but really uncomfortable, right? This isn't damaging. It's not an argument with a loved one. It's not a bottle of whiskey. It's like, it's uncomfortable, but it's ultimately supportive. But then when we face those, that then we learn how, I feel like it's a practice that we learn how to lean into other things that are uncomfortable, you know, in the things in our regular life, whether it's, you know, uncomfortable conversations with a loved one, something at work. I think it sort of supports that skill a little bit. And we wouldn't necessarily draw the line from, oh, I go cold water swimming to I sort of lean into things or try new things that make me uncomfortable or speak my mind or, you know, even things like that. But I do think it's a practice that helps you. So you take Sarah, but she went more frequently in the beginning, right? Like once people get a practice, you're talking about, hey, even once a week is wildly beneficial. So how does that work? Is it sort of like, hey, try to do it more often in the beginning, or how does that work?
Not necessarily. We had to do it all in one go with Sarah because we were filming it for the BBC. So, and that was it. So what we did was the first day we went into the pool. So Mike at Portsmouth has, you know, he's got this thing called the Extreme Environments Lab. It's an amazing place. You know, it's, you know, you can adjust the oxygen levels in there. You can adjust the temperature. You can adjust the humidity, all these things. You've got an endless pool there. So we took her in and adapted her over a day. Now that was interesting as well, because after the second time, she said she didn't want to go back in. You know, and so we said, that's fine, just take your time, you know, it doesn't matter. And this is coming back to your earlier point about how do you pitch it to someone, how are you honest about it. And then she said, okay, I'll just go back in one more time eventually. You know, we just let her do her thing, no force at all, and she went back in, and then god, this is really good. Yeah, you know, she really enjoyed it. I think that's something to be really really take in, is that the first time, you know, you're just ready for it. I'm doing it. The second time, that's the worst. And then the third time, you begin to kind of get the hang of it. Mm-hmm. But this seems to work. So we did that over a day. And then the next day we went out and swam with her in a lake. But this is the same, even if you do it every week. So once a week, I reckon, is enough. And you do it once a week. And some of the cold water adaptation programs that have been used experimentally do take this approach. So if you do it once a week, and again, the third time, the second time is probably going to be the worst, but so it's a matter of sticking with it. So that's one of the key things I try and get across, is you stick with it, you do it. So I'm going to do it six times. And then if you don't like it after that, you know, you're not going to like it.
Right. And you give people sort of like, I don't want to say a toolkit, but, you know, bathing cap, knowing your exit, like you even sort of make, you kind of take away some of the other barriers. And do you suggest a bright color cap because of keeping the heat, or people can see you? What exactly are the things that you like for people to have?
Yeah, so the hat is for both of those things. One, it's so you're easily visible, and that's great. And the other thing is you do lose heat through your head. I mean, it's interesting. There's this classic thing that you lose 95% of your heat through the head. But that comes from a study where people were in full immersion suits. The only part that was exposed was the face, or the neck and the face. So, but you do actually lose proportionately more heat from your head. So it's, you know, that figure's a myth, but you do proportionately lose more heat. So I think that's a really good thing to have, because you don't want to lose it. But although, and putting your face in the water is very important. We can come on to why that is later. Yeah. But with the rest of the kit, you know, it's about making it as good as it can be. You have to expose yourself to that challenge. But when the water's below 10 degrees, I just find it so cold on my hands and my feet that I wear gloves and shoes. And I'm sure you get the benefit. I mean, because basically you're just putting your body in. That's what's giving you that strong reaction. It's not the pain. It's not getting into ice. You don't have to get into ice.
Right. I do that too. I'll be honest with you. I do a lot of icing, and sometimes my hands will be the thing that gets me out of there quicker. Like, I worked my feet into it, and they adjusted very well. There's been suggestions that maybe it's a circulation. You improve your circulation so that sort of burning actually diminishes. But sometimes in some days, like, I don't know if you ever find this, if it's cloudier or it's later and I'm tired, my tolerance is less. So I want to remind people too, when they experiment, and I'd love to hear your feelings, is I feel like sort of earlier, when we have a little more energy and we have sort of a physical tolerance, it does make it a little easier. But also the things, like you said, that would get you out. Like for me, if it's my hands, there are days I just slide my hands out. And like, if I'm sitting in the ice and I go, hey, the things that's going to trip me up right now is my hands, I just slide them out. And you're saying, like, if you know it's just too cold for you at that moment, putting booties on. But if you've had a very stressful day, it can go either way, right? Like, this cold therapy can either really help it put it in perspective. And sometimes I think you just don't have it. If you've really gotten beaten up by your day, I think going into the cold feels more intolerable.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, our temperature regulation goes down when we're tired. Yeah, we lose our temperature regulation. It's one of the first things to go. So it's not good to go. And the other thing is, you know, I stress about going in when you're warm. And first thing in the morning, it's funny. Yeah, I go in at 7 o'clock, which I normally do before work, because that's great. That means I feel good for the rest of the day. I have so much energy for the day. But the occasionally I'll go a bit later, and you know, even going at 9 o'clock, that feels so much easier. But then, as you say, you go through the day, you become more tired. Towards the end of the day, it's going to get more difficult. Cloud again. Sun has a disproportionate effect. You know, it's not for me, and I haven't got the science to back this up, but for me, having a bit of sun makes such a difference, even if the temperature is exactly the same.
I don't know what that is, but I sit in the nice tub in a gray sky. It just feels like it's just a lot harder. So I guess what I'm saying is, I'm setting this table because if someone is sort of really intrigued by this, and I would really encourage people to try this, your book is very easy to read. It's, you know, I read it in just a bit of time. Is also set yourself up, if you can, at least the initial times for success. So, you know, maybe being with somebody that makes you feel calm, not agitated. Like you said, have these tools, have the right, you know, things on. A little sun wouldn't be the worst, and don't do it after a very, very long day. I loved also the story where you talked about how when bathing suits were created, and then that's when sort of people started to actually swim. And I never really thought about that. Like, you just sort of think, oh, people have always been swimming. But the case is unless maybe you were working in the water or fishing, I don't know really what the call, why would you swim? And you talked about how the creation of swimsuits got people in the water. And what was the woman, Martha
Gunn?
Yes, yeah. She was like almost an original lifeguard, or maybe you could share about Martha Gunn.
Well, basically this shows what I'm doing isn't original. What I'm doing is adding a bit of science to things. But all this was done in the mid 18th century in Brighton. Yeah, that's where I live now. And there's a guy called Richard Russell, who was known as Dr. Brighton, and he built this thing up. And for the next 150 years, maybe longer, it was a massive thing. All this, the spa treatments, the bathing and things like this. And the way he got people in and the way people went into the water with these people called dippers. And Martha Gunn was one of the most famous dippers. She, the future King George IV came and had his daughter. I think the story goes that when she was still a baby, dipped in the sea in Brighton. And that was it. You know, so swimsuits had to develop. They weren't really swimsuits as we'd think about them now, but that's when they started to be developed. And you know, they get these carriages drawn into the water, and they just go in one end of the carriage, out the other, into the water, and then come back out again. You have people like Martha Gunn pulling them, you know, making sure they came, because people couldn't swim. They didn't know what swimming was, really.
Right. And I, you know, a lot of people maybe don't have access. You were saying in England that maybe, I think it's something like over 7 million people are doing versions of this, or at least swimming in the water, cold water swims.
Yeah. It's just incredible how it's just taken off over the last few years.
So if people are sitting in, Ohio, let's say, and they're, you know, sort of landlocked, obviously cold showers, Wim Hof talks a lot about cold showers, 30 seconds, a few minutes, things like that. There's a lot of benefits to that. So the ultimate, and I really would like you to sort of maybe just expand a little bit about the benefits of this being in the sea, you know, being in a natural body of water, but also just kind of touch upon some of the other ways people can get these benefits of being in the cold, because it can be available.
Yeah. So I think to understand how to get the benefits of the cold, you need to understand how it works in a way. So there are two aspects to the effect this challenge has. And the first is how cold the water is, or how cold the environment is. You know, you can use cryo chambers, but they're air, so they have to be so much colder, because air doesn't hold as much heat, and therefore it doesn't take away as much heat as quickly as you. And that's why they have to be quite so cold. And the other is the rate of cooling, and water takes heat away from you very, very quickly. So what you're going to think about is, well, a shower, that probably isn't as cold as cold water, but it is colder than normal. And it doesn't cool you down as quickly as if you're totally put in, you know, totally immersed in cold water. But a cold bath, that's going to be more effective. A cold bath with a load of ice cubes in, that's going to be even more effective. So that kind of, so you can use these other things. I think with the sea to me really gives it the waves. It depends where you are. You know, where I am in Norway, no waves, none at all. You know, but where I'm in Brighton, there are amazing, you know, there are waves, and it really adds something to it. You know, because it's a bit more of a challenge. You have to think about it. It takes you again out of your thoughts, out of all that rubbish going on in your head. So you think, right, okay, there are waves, I need to get in there, whatever. So that adds something. But overall, I think that's relatively minor difference to, say, going in to a river or a lake or something like that. You know, it's still outside, and we know that going outside is good for you. We know that blue therapy, a view of water, has an additional effect. And also, when we do this thing, you know, if you have a bath or a shower, maybe you do it with someone. I don't think it's that much fun though, really. If it's a cold shower, at any rate. Yeah. And, you know, so getting out and doing it with a group of people makes a massive difference. One, it reduces the social isolation, which, again, we know is really good for you. And two, it encourages you to go back in. If you're with a group of people, you know, some of the courses we've run, you know, and these are for people with clinical anxiety and depression, one of the things they get back to is, some days I just didn't want to go, but I couldn't let the rest of the group down. Yeah.
We all need, listen, I don't care who we are. We all need these. I say this all the time. It's how all the systems in place to help us be successful. And I think that accountability and that kind of encouragement, there's something so powerful connecting with people around something that ultimately is good for everybody. And also someone being there like for your victory too, like, hey, you got this today. And there's a beautiful exchange, and you talk a lot about the importance of the socialization part of this component, which I really appreciate, because it isn't just about, hey, adaptation and inflammation, but it is talking, you know, revisiting going into nature and talking about the blue therapy and connecting that community. Because, you know, we no one can imagine all of the reasons why people are feeling what they're feeling, but it seems like a lot of the same things can help whatever it is.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you talk about, yeah, you need all these tools, and yeah, you talk about, yeah, you need as many tools as you can in your toolbox, whether it's nutrition, this, that, and the other. But what I think you get with cold water swimming or outdoor swimming specifically is, you know, a pretty well packed toolbox. I mean, it's not everything, you know, it's not a miracle cure. But, you know, that's a pretty good toolbox you've got there to be starting with.
This podcast is brought to you by Ritual. I personally have been taking their multivitamins since, well, right when COVID started. I needed one, and I learned all about Ritual, and I've been taking it ever since. And they know, listen, that women really do need to be a part of the scientific research. And they conducted a university-led human clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin to assess its efficacy. And the results? It increased vitamin D levels by 43%. We all know the importance of vitamin D. And omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks. So they are really very big, not only on the science, but making sure that the ingredients are traceable, clean, and in a bioavailable form, which means your body knows what to do with the actual nutrients once it gets it. And the way they did it is so simple. They took 9 key nutrients in 2 delayed release capsules per day that optimize your body's absorption. And it's really easy because it's gentle on an empty stomach. If you're rushing around, you can't be like, oh, I have to get my vitamins, but I need to eat first. It even has a nice little minty essence right at the end after you take it. So you don't have those weird, I call them vitamin burps. I'm not loving it. And Ritual multivitamins are vegan, non-GMO, Project Verified, gluten and major allergen free, certified B Corp. And like I said earlier, everything is traceable. So no more funny business, nothing shady. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is a multivitamin you can actually trust. You can get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/Gabby. That's Ritual, ritual.com/Gabby. You can start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today at ritual.com/Gabby for 25% off.
My husband and I were talking, and do we know, this is just out of curiosity, is there, we were talking, you know, obviously the challenge in waves and maybe even walking like on sand or rocks, there's all kinds of, you know, grounding and beautiful things that happen for you. But do we know if there's any sort of difference being in salt water versus fresh or ice baths? Or is it just sort of like, hey, cold is cold and whatever you have access to or whatever tickles your fancy, do that?
Yeah. So for me, I don't know of any difference as such. You know, there is those things that you talk about. But so I don't think there's fundamentally any difference with the cold, but it's all the stuff around it. And, you know, it is the waves. So it's not the salt water or the fresh water as such. It's the environment and that means community as well as the physical environment.
In the book, you talk about, it isn't just, you know, because I've learned, obviously there's a very big difference between anxiety and depression and feeling anxious and being sad. But you do talk also about people who have chronic pain, migraines, fibromyalgia, PTSD, autoimmune disease. So you guys have been really exploring a lot of different ailments that people experience that this seems to support.
Yeah, well, that's quite interesting because where we've come to this is from, you know, the first study we ran. So we had Sarah along, and you know, it worked. And you know, just as I was going along for a first swim and all that, and I said to Chris, I said, yeah, what if this doesn't work? My whole theory's blown out of the water. And he said, don't worry, it always works on TV. So of course, then after that, we need to actually do it in real life. So we ran these courses. We got 59, a clinical study for people with diagnosed anxiety and or depression. We got 59 people through that. Now, you talk about the fibromyalgia. So people, there's a guy there, Martin. Now, he came along because he was anxious. He's been a lifelong worrier, suffered from anxiety, clinical anxiety. He came along to try and sort out his anxiety. But what he suffers from fibromyalgia, and he noticed coincidentally that the symptoms of his fibromyalgia got better. And yeah, he comes out with just a wonderful comment, which is, you know, when you come out of the water, I feel alert, alive, and I have a sense of euphoria and achievement. And, you know, the act of taking a pill is never going to give you that. And that's what you get from the swimming. But, you know, so we've seen a lot of these other conditions being improved by cold water swimming. But most of this has come off the back of a complete coincidence. And like Beth, who the one who had migraines, you know, she was having 28 migraines a month. I mean, just imagine. And according to the World Health Organization, that's as bad as being paraplegic when you have a migraine like she had. Yeah. But she read about just being out in nature and thought, well, how can I be out in nature? I can't just lie inside all day. And so they just thought, oh, well, her and her now husband said, oh, let's try swimming in the sea for 100 days and make a film about it. She's a filmmaker. But she coincidentally noticed the migraines were getting better, and it enabled her, didn't fix it, but enabled her to get back to school and get back and finish her PhD, which she'd had to give up.
Yeah. I think, you know, you talked a little bit about Mike Morris creating the chill therapy.
Yeah.
And that this isn't, you know, again, people have been doing it. You mentioned in your book about philosophers and all, you know, always being drawn to the sea. And I always find it amazing that we're so smart now and we live in such a modern way that we've forgotten so many really basic ways to support ourselves, and as simple as being with one another in an uncomfortable environment. And have you found, like I said, we do an ice tub, so that's 32 degrees. But is there sort of a kind of, obviously 68 degrees would be a lot more fun, but is there one that's sort of a sweet spot where you're going, hey, we're sort of getting a lot of extra benefits, but it's just not so brutally cold? Is it, you know, is it 50 degrees? Is there some temperature that really is showing up as a really great number for you when you guys are doing this?
Well, we haven't done the studies as a, you know, in the clinical studies we've been doing, but I think there are two sweet spots you can think about. So the range of 10 to 14 degrees centigrade, that is probably where you get your maximum adaptation. We see, yeah, we don't see any more adaptation below 10 degrees. I think you probably get more of a, maybe you get more of a physiological effect, but not so much. The vast majority comes by the time you get to 10. Of course, it feels a lot colder and it feels a lot more brutal. But also, you know, at 20 degrees, you know, at 68, you're getting maximum vasoconstriction. Yeah, in other words, you know, your vessels don't constrict any more than that. So what this shows us is that even at 20 degrees, you're having a really good really strong physiological reaction. So something is really happening. And that's the other sweet spot, 15 to 20, where you know below 20, it's good. And certainly from my own experience, it goes a bit above 20. I love it, but it's just not quite as good. And that's not brutally cold at all. So maybe you're getting 60, 70% of the effect between 15 and 20, and that's a pretty good amount. And you're getting 80, 90, possibly even more of the effect between 10 and 15 degrees centigrade.
You know, I when we have people come and we do these experiences, I do want to remind people, because you talked about the breathing, we just have them concentrate on slowing down the inhales and the exhales, because like you said, you get this involuntary sort of, it's almost like a hyperventilation. You can even see it on their face, the mouth, the whole everything. And so I that has been really helpful to get people to slow it all down and give them something else to think about other than like, it's cold. It's like, yes, it is cold. How long on average are you swimming in the sea, and are you doing it, you know, sort of 5-6 days a week? Are you doing it that often?
It varies. Yeah. It depends where I'm working, so I work half the year in Norway. If I'm working during the winter, it's quite difficult to get, sometimes it's frozen, so it's a bit too much to do it. But sometimes I will swim 4 or 5 times a week, and that's great. But you really don't have to be in very long. So what I say is, you go in long enough to get control of over your breathing again. And you know how it is. You go in and that's that first bit, and then it gets better. And suddenly you're fine. And it's interesting. I took a load of school kids. I took my son's class, they're 16, 17 year olds in. And we did a day of experiments on the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. And of course, we took them in for a swim. And it's great because they go in. And of course, I tell them all that. I said, you're going to hyperventilate, but stay in. And within a minute or so, and they go in and it's all, and lots of noise. And then you just hear the calm descend upon them, and they start, the laughing comes and the giggling, and it's all so much smoother. So I would say you just do not have to be in that long. If you're in long enough, you get past that initial shock, then that's long enough, because you don't want to be in so long that you become hypothermic. Getting cold, your core getting cold is not good for you. Taking that challenge, getting through that challenge, getting out, that's what's good for you.
Yeah. And you really are adamant about when people get out that they get dry right away and get in something warm. Something that we try to practice here when we can, and it's obviously different if you're coming out, let's say it's winter where you are, when you're in the Scandinavian country, you're going to be coming out in cold. But something else that we try to practice is when we come out trying to warm ourselves up on our own, so that we become more efficient at either side of the spectrum, because we do couple the sauna with ice. My husband will go on the ice first. I don't really enjoy that. I'm not going to lie. I really like going into the sauna and then going into the ice. But what we try to do is have a little gap in between so that the body has to work a little bit to either cool itself down or warm itself up, just to maybe become more efficient at that. But you, because you are in nature, are saying, hey, when you get out, get warm and get dry. That's important.
Yeah, and get out of the wind. Because the thing is, depends on how long you've been in the water, because you can get cold very quickly. And, because once you're out of the water, that it isn't over, because all your skin, so you've got your core, which your body's very good at maintaining temperature with, but that periphery, it's like kind of a storage heater or a storage cooler. So if that's all super cold, you're going to want to, your body is going to seep into your system. That cold conducts into the core, and you can become very cold very quickly. And it really exacerbates it being caught in the wind. And again, that layer of cold water on your skin actually, will take a lot of heat out of your body. So that's why it's important to do it. But I think, it's really good. Being warm when you go in, this is why you need to be warm when you go in, is because then your storage heater is a storage heater. It's got lots of warmth to give back to you. Whereas if you're going cold, it hasn't. But warming up, the best way to warm up either before or afterwards is internally, from the inside out. So that's using your muscles. So that's doing your own thing. It's exercising. In fact, it's interesting. There's one study which showed that if you warm up passively, so you just got a heater or something like that before you go into the water, you actually cool down quicker than if you hadn't warmed up before at all. Whereas if you warmed up from the inside out, you warm down slower. Now, of course, if you've been in a sauna and you're warm all the way through, that's not a problem. It's when you sort of got a bit of cold, warm on the outside, cold in the next bit, and warm in the middle. That's the problem.
And I really appreciated you bringing up breathing and using breathing techniques to ramp up and to warm up before you go in. I thought that was really important. Do you talk a little bit in the book about cold shock proteins? We hear a lot, and there's a lot more studies on heat shock proteins. And so besides the inflammation, is there anything else about the cold shock proteins, maybe for, I believe, dementia or things like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is really early work.
Yep.
Yeah. But what has been shown is that people, so it was quite fun. They did a study where they took people who swam regularly in an outdoor swimming pool, you know, through the winter in London. And they had a control group. I think this is fantastic. They had a control group who, while they were swimming in the water, this lot, a control group doing Tai Chi on the side of the pool. And they measured their cold shock proteins. And cold shock proteins, the importance of these is they're what rebuilds the neurons and the synapses in hibernating animals when they wake up. And what we lose in dementia is the number of synapses. And so they did show that these were built up in the cold people compared to those doing Tai Chi. So, you know, it's going to be good. How good it is and whether it staves off dementia, I think that's a study that I can't see any way how you're going to do it, but it's another positive thing.
That's it. For me, I don't always need everything to be wrapped in a bow, and I do appreciate science, but those stories or tales, I think, can be inspiring of just sort of, you know, seeing where things lean towards. And people who wait for all the science, that's a lot of time sometimes, because all those studies. Have you ever had a period in your life where maybe you were so busy, you say you have a son, where you had like a period of time that you didn't get into the water? And obviously you seem like a naturally, you know, happy, healthy person, but I was just curious if you've had gaps in your life where you didn't get to go into the sea.
Well, I suppose the thing is, there have been, what I have done is absolutely prioritize getting into the sea, either in the pool, you know, that's my training, or in the sea. You know, that is my number one priority. You know, I can give up everything else, you know, and that's fine. You know, the busy times of my life, if I get that, and, you know, and there's some days, you know, I've had a really bad day, or I've had it, you know, I know I'm going to have a really hard day, and maybe it's been hard at home and whatever. And I think I've got to get my swim in. So there haven't been that long periods of time, but I do notice it. When I haven't, it's not great. But I mean, they're also, you know, it's more about, you can use it therapeutically. I mean, one of the nurses at work told me the other day that they'd had a really bad night at work. You know, a child had died, and that's just truly awful. And, you know, no one's fault. You know, it wasn't, you know, nothing anyone could have done, but it still feels awful. And she left work. And this was a night shift. So she left work at 8 o'clock in the morning and said, I need a swim. You know, she's been convinced by me to start swimming. I said, I need a swim. And she went down, had a swim. And she said, God, that made all the difference. So the one side is, yeah, you do notice it when you haven't had the swim. But the other thing is, you can realize, I can use this. You know, I have had that hard time. I am really struggling. Get into a swim. And that does help.
Mm. And that's, for me, that's all I want to talk about. I just want to talk about the things that are positive, that we know there's no downside, that can support us. And if any of this seems appealing, like someone, I think people listen to things and they think, now that's something that would interest me, that they're just reminded that it's available and it's out there. So the book is called Chill, and it's out July 12th. I love the color, by the way. I just love the blue. So it's so great. And Mark, is there anything else that maybe I forgot, or you know, that you feel is really important that you want to share?
I think what I really like to get across is, keep it simple. One, it's very safe for most people. I mean, 99% of people, probably, it's very safe as long as you follow a few simple rules, which are rules I set out in the book. And the rules are just common sense. And to come back to my comment from earlier, it doesn't need to be too cold. It doesn't need to be for too long. And it doesn't need to be too often. Once a week is fine. One thing we actually haven't touched upon is also get your face in the water, because this stimulates the vagus nerve. And that has a direct effect on your inflammatory system. So it reduces your inflammation directly. So whereas what you're getting with the adapting to cold is your baseline levels of stress and inflammation go down, and your peaks of stress and inflammation go down. So they're more in that physiological good zone than in the bad pathological zone. So that's a long-term effect. But with the face, every time you go in, you know, that is having a positive effect and damping down that inflammation. And again, like when you get into the water, you just have to stay in long enough that you get your breath back and you're past that bad bit. With the face, put it in, it's a few seconds, it's not in and out, it's a few seconds. Let that bad bit go past and then take it out. So I've sort of say roughly 3 minutes and putting your face in three times. And it's your face, it's not your whole head, it's just your face.
Yeah, that's a great reminder. And if people want to find you or connect with you, where can they do that?
Well, I've got a very basic social media skill, shall we say. But you can find me on Instagram or Twitter at thewildswimdoctor. And also, you know, check out chilluk.org, which is the company that Mike and I set up to run these courses for people. And actually, another really great site is mentalhealthswims.org. You know, they're a group, which I talk about in the book a bit, who have set up just, you know, meetups for people with mental health conditions who just want to go and have a swim. And just, yeah, it's nothing formal. It's just go along and join a group of people.
Now, I know you said when it's cold, you might wear booties and gloves, but are you literally like in just like a Speedo, like that's what you're wearing?
Yeah, basically. that's it. Yeah. It's getting your body in. That's the key to it. Yeah. And that's why I just feel so good afterwards.
Yeah. Dr. Harper, thank you so much. And I really appreciate what you're doing and the way you're doing it. I think this idea, there's a playfulness and sort of a fun spirit around it. And just thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I was so glad you totally got it. The playfulness, having the fun. Yeah, it's fantastic to talk to you.
That wraps it up for today. Make sure to follow us on Spotify for free episodes and subscribe to The Gabby Reece Show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow me at Gabby Reece on Instagram and Twitter. Aloha.